Welcome to The Playlist Podcast, a weekly discussion of films and TV. I'm your host, Charles Barfield, managing editor of The Playlist. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Mike D'Angelo and Brian Farver. Are you guys ready to talk about one of the greatest filmmakers to ever live?
Heck yeah. And especially now. We haven't been together like doing this in quite a while.
I know.
We took a bit of a break.
I was going to say, before we get into it, I got to say how happy I am to do like a regular discussion episode with you guys. It's been too long.
As everybody tunes out knowing that we're not interviewing John Carpenter, but either way.
Brian, quick, do your John Carpenter and we'll talk to you for an hour.
Oh, okay.
He literally doesn't change voice. So.
Just talk about
don't like anything I've done anymore.
Shit on Hollywood and talk about how you love playing video games.
Hey, you were just doing my Mark Webb voice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. But so there's been plenty of good reasons why we've taken this far of a break. But yeah, it's great to come back and shoot the shit. So I'm excited. Yeah. And what better thing to talk about than John Carpenter, a filmmaker that's near and dear to my heart. So
amen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why are we talking about John Carpenter this week? Well, we're smack dab in the middle of two important anniversaries for Carpenter classics. July 1st marked the 35th anniversary of Big Trouble in Little China. And July 10th marks the 40th anniversary of Escape from New York. And fans of those movies can agree those are two hugely influential films from one of the greatest American directors of all time. So for this episode, we're going to talk about those films a little bit, their impact on the film world today, and just kind of talk about Carpenter and what makes him so awesome. But before we get to that, I got to tell you, the Playlist Podcast is part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which includes Be Real, The Fourth Wall, Deep Focus, and more. And if you want to find us, you can check your podcast app of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, Anchor, Stitcher, or anywhere else you find your favorite shows. Okay, gentlemen, let's give the listeners a bit of a John Carpenter 101 if they're not familiar. Most people know him because he's the writer and director of the original Halloween in 1978, which revolutionized horror and basically laid the groundwork for the modern slasher. But what really sets Carpenter apart is what he did over a 10-year period from the late 70s to late 80s. Before Halloween in 1976, he did Assault on Precinct 13, which is an underrated thriller. Then after Halloween, he wrote and directed the horror film The Fog in 1980, Escape from New York in 1981, The Thing in 1982, Christine in 1983, Starman in 1984, Big Trouble in Little China in 1986, Prince of Darkness in 1987, and then They Live in 1988. So honestly, outside of Steven Spielberg, you'd be hard-pressed to find a director with a 10-year run with that many classics. Would you guys agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's definitely some, but that stand up with that, that's one hell of a run.
Yeah, and I know Mike and I talked about this briefly, but if you want to compare him to Spielberg, and I will fight that fight, I would give Carpenter the slight edge because he directed the movies, but he also wrote them, and he did most of the music. Yes. So come on. And he was working with like a fraction of the budgets, but I digress.
True. He's a smaller filmmaker.
How dare you?
I'm
sure he's just as tall as Steven Spielberg, but so to begin, I want to just ask you guys about your Carpenter experiences and specifically that run of films, and any of them stand out more than others. Are you guys big Starman fans? Start with Brian.
Actually, as a matter of fact, yes, I do like Starman. And I actually didn't see it until not that many years ago. But of those films, and I would also say Escape from New York, I saw more recently than that. Yeah, I would say those two really stand out. And Starman, especially, I mean, if you look at his list of films just in general, I mean, he definitely has more of a, we'll say, horror slant. Starman, I think, is a good example of what his kind of outside the genre films are like, because he's very good overall, but Starman still manages to capture kind of this starkness, this bleakness that a lot of his films have, even though it's absolutely not a horror film. So yeah, Starman, I loved Starman, and I think I still do. It's been
talking too much about Starman.
I am. That's all we're talking about, right?
Yes. Starman. It's the 37th anniversary of Starman. We'll definitely talk about that. Mike, what are your highlights?
I'm a big Carpenter head, especially that 10-year run that we're mentioning right now. Obviously, the thing that introduced me to him was Halloween. I watched those from about way too early. I was like 10 years old when I saw Halloween, and like watched them over and over and over again as I was growing up. So that's like my favorite horror film franchise.
How did you see them? When did you see them?
All on like DVD or like VHS. Actually, yeah. Okay. They were probably VHS, or they were like on USA Network and edited horror.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I watched those, and then, you know, over and over and over again. And then eventually I was like, oh, I should probably watch more John Carpenter films because I love Halloween so much. And then, you know, probably high school or college, it took that long. I watched The Thing and it blew my mind, and it's still like one of my favorite all-time movies ever.
Yeah.
And The Fog, and like just pretty much any of that 80s run I went through pretty quickly, except for Christine, which I watched for the first time all the way through today.
It's
not bad, you know, but it's definitely got some of that Carpenter charm to it, and like that bleakness that you were talking about. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are some things that don't age great. We'll just leave it there. But
the guy from Back to School is amazing. Sure.
But of those, I mean, Halloween, The Thing, The Fog, Big Trouble, Escape from New York, those are all like, you could put any of those on and that would be like, I'd be a happy person.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people kind of poke fun at They Live because of the kind of, what is it? The 5 or 10 minute straight, or I think it might be longer than that, fight between Roddy Piper and his co-star. I'm blanking on the names, but it's kind of silly. But that movie, you know, of all the movies he's done, maybe outside of Halloween, that's the most memed movie in his career. They Live, like the message of They Live has probably outlasted the movie to the point where people who share the memes or joke about like the glasses that show like the real meaning behind things, like I probably have never seen the movie, but yeah,
I really got to watch that again because I think I've seen it all the way through like once or twice.
Oh, it's great.
I should revisit.
Roddy Piper, again, if there's one thing I'll say about Carpenter, he takes guys that specifically Kurt Russell and Roddy Piper, these people who were known for not doing what they ended up doing for Carpenter, you know. Kurt Russell was, what was he, Elvis, and did like some Disney movies. And then Carpenter's like,
or John Carpenter.
Yeah, yeah. And then he was like, Carpenter's like, you'd be great as Snake Plissken, you know, like what? Mm-hmm. And then Roddy Piper was a wrestler who did like some real bad B movies. Hell Comes a Frog Town, which I actually have on I think 4K even.
Sounds like something Brian would bring up, but okay.
Yeah, no. But yeah, he takes this guy who's a wrestler, did B movies, and then he does They Live, which is like a fucking classic. So anyway.
You do not besmirch Roddy Piper.
No, RIP Roddy. He's great. I loved him growing up. But for me, I think the movies that stand out outside of Halloween, I think Halloween's kind of the gold standard of all of his movies. But then you look at like Escape from New York and The Thing were only a year apart. And that's nuts because those movies are like just flat out classics. You could put them on today, 40 years after they came out, and people would be just blown away at how timeless they are.
Yeah,
dude, there especially are
the thing, that thing.
Yeah, The Thing. That's what. Yeah, go on. I'm sorry.
It ages so well.
Yeah, it does.
I cannot believe how well that movie ages. Out of all of them, I think that holds up the best.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Halloween.
That, like, I think if you put it up against The Thing, it's just yes, it's crazier and gorier, but the practical effects.
Yeah.
Oh. They're like second to none. They're amazing.
It really is.
And it holds up.
But I just quickly about Halloween, I watched it at an entirely too young age, probably because of cable TV or Blockbuster Video. But I remember being so young and terrified of hedges, like tall hedges, because I was convinced Michael Myers was behind the hedge and he was going to jump out and get me.
Absolutely. And he was.
Yeah, of course. To this day, I'm convinced. Okay, so that's kind of our overview of Carpenter. Obviously, we like him, but we're going to dive deeper into a couple of the movies that are celebrating those anniversaries. So first one's Escape from New York. It's got 40 years now, which is nuts. For those that don't know, Escape from New York's the first appearance of Snake Plissken. Should have been probably his last appearance. But
Escape from LA.
Yeah. Played by the incredible Kurt Russell, the film's set in a future, 1997, where Manhattan is one huge walled-off prison colony and Snake Plissken is a criminal given the opportunity for a clean slate. If he breaks into Manhattan, rescues the president of the United States and gets out within 22 hours, I believe. So it's kind of saying it in 2021. You're like, I've seen this movie 15 times. But honestly, you had like before Escape from New York, there wasn't anything like this. You know, there wasn't The Rock. There wasn't, the Michael Bay version, The Rock, not yeah. Dwayne Johnson. You know, there weren't these movies where it's like, let's send this criminal in, right? So, you know, it's a great movie, but I want to talk to Mike first. What are your thoughts about Escape from New York? Because I know you recently just rewatched it.
Yeah, I watched that one and the other one we're talking about yesterday. So a Kurt Russell, John Carpenter-a-thon. And yeah. It was quite pleasant. Donald Pleasance.
Excellent. For those that don't know, Donald Pleasance from Halloween fame returns as the president. He returns as the president for Escape from New York and has a weird accent for an American president, but you know.
Yeah, he does.
Don't worry about it. That's what we just kind of ignore.
Yeah, it's the crazy world of 1997. Shit gets weird.
Absolutely. 1997 is one hell of a future. I think, you know, there are some things that are kind of corny and, you know, don't hold up as well as some of the others. But for me, it's just so charming and like super Carpenter-y, that, I mean, there's all that darkness and the sci-fi elements that went on to inspire like a whole genre as well. Like, can we just stop and talk about how many genres he's like fucking punched in the ass and like rewritten basically. So and this one, you know, I was saying this to Charles before, you can't get the first Terminator without this movie, Escape from New York,
literally, because in our research we found that James Cameron did some of the matte paintings and was the director of photography for parts of Escape from New York. So there you go.
Like, really? Hey, let me just take some of these matte paintings and just use them over here. But yeah, so
dark cityscape.
Yeah, but it's charming. It's kind of slow, but a lot of Carpenter films are slow and kind of drawn out and dreadful, but that's kind of on purpose. So if that's your thing, that's your thing. And I think this one overall holds up. The Snake Plissken of it all, the badass, like raspy, almost like a Clint Eastwood kind of guy dropped into a sci-fi movie that hadn't been done before, as far as I know.
And what's crazy about Escape, because I rewatched it too for the millionth time, is you talk about slow. This movie starts, which is white letters on black screen going through the credits, which is the synth score. And then it goes to like this weird narration where they set the stage where like 1988, crime is on the rise by 400% and blah, blah, blah. And they basically just lay out the ground rules for the movie. And then you're introduced to like this beautiful like helicopter shot of like this rundown Manhattan of the future. And you forget that he made this movie for like $6 million. Like there was like no money there. And it looks just as good as something that was probably made in 2021, which is not, you know, that's hard to do for a movie that's 40 years old, but he did it. And I think it's a lot of it's the practicalness of it all, you know.
Yeah,
there's no CGI at all in this movie. You know, they one thing I read about the movie is they were worried it was going to be too expensive to like trash New York City. So they ended up shooting in St. Louis because parts of St. Louis already looked really like run down and like everything.
A trashy New York City.
Yeah. So they were just like, well, we can save money and we can just shoot in St. Louis to make it look terrible.
It's just like, hey, we don't even have to fuck this place up.
But yeah, no, it's great. Brian, what are your thoughts on Escape from New York?
You know, I remember when I saw this, I saw The Warriors around the same time. So I definitely, it's interesting that like, yeah, I can't believe 40 years old. And I think, if correct me if I'm wrong, The Warriors came out maybe a year or two before that.
It might even be longer than that.
I know Warriors is not a Carpenter film, but I remember thinking there's a interesting comparison here. Both movies, I think, still look really, really good. At the same time, very much looking like that era. They have that, I don't want to say dated, that's the wrong choice of word, but it's almost like, well, you can tell this was not made now, but at the same time, it doesn't matter because it's still just, any movie that tries to capture the now, sadly, what was once the distant future and now is kind of the distant past. I think that poster is great with the with just the numbers 1997 and big numbers at the top. Like, oh yeah.
What's crazy is it wasn't even that far in the future. Like.
Yeah.
It was only 16 years after the movie came out. Exactly. Like, it wasn't like he was like 2045. No.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
But yeah, like I've in watching it, like I could really appreciate the cinematography. The music is awesome. And I look forward to talking a little bit more about that in a bit. Cause I don't know how his mind operates, but that is, I would have to say that rivals Halloween in terms of, terms of his soundtrack work. I really do.
It's think hard because Halloween has that theme.
I know.
You can't escape that theme.
That's the thing.
No, but, it's the Halloween.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's John Carpenter episode.
And we're done. But like,
also, yeah. Shout out to Ernest Borgnine as the cat.
Yes, as Cabby.
Oh yes, that yes, forgetting
and Borg. And Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah,
as Brain, aka
there's a lot of good stuff in here.
Wait a minute, was that now he had a really long Kurt Russell had a super long contract with Disney, correct? Did he? Yeah. Did he go right from Disney?
Yeah.
Was this his first movie after Disney?
No. I don't think it was his first movie after Disney, but I know that when, because they had other people in mind. Okay. Doing research, you find out that, like, basically Carpenter wrote this during the 70s because in a response to Watergate, where, you know, the government sucks and he wanted to make a movie about how the president couldn't be trusted and blah, 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 blah. So he makes this Escape from New York because, of course, Carpenter would have, you know, come up with this in response to Watergate. Mm-hmm. And he also was inspired by Death Wish, apparently, because of how it presented New York City, kind of dirty, grimy, all that. But he obviously doesn't agree with the politics of Death Wish. So he was like trying to cast people and they brought up, you know, Charles Bronson, of course, because Charles Bronson, for those that don't know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, he was like the badass action dude, right?
Yes. Which is so absurd.
I know, it's crazy.
Back in.
but he was too old. Carpenter wanted him to be younger. And so he was like Kurt Russell. And they're like, Disney is Kurt Russell? He's like Kurt fucking Russell. And there you go.
What would that crazy casting be like nowadays? Like, who could we compare that to? Like,
Wyatt Russell.
Yeah. I mean, people have asked him this, and I've seen him say, hell no, I would never do that. But I would love to see it.
There are moments.
This is a movie that could definitely be remade.
Oh yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Totally update this.
Well, so last we heard Lee Whannell from Upgrade and Invisible Man fame.
Yes.
Is signed to do a remake. Oh. And he said he would love to have Wyatt Russell. And you watch this movie, especially after watching like Falcon and Winter Soldier, you see Wyatt Russell and Kurt Russell so much.
Of course.
They're almost like, obviously, because they're related. But, you know, it's a young Kurt Russell is basically today's Wyatt Russell.
Oh, man.
I would love to see that.
That's a dream team right there. Oh, my God. That's exciting.
Yeah. So, and the other thing I want to bring out about this movie is it's a very punk rock movie, not in like the like aesthetic sense, because it's very much like a sci-fi action movie. But you're talking about a guy who's got $6 million, John Carpenter, who's coming off doing Halloween and The Fog, and he's like, I want to make this sci-fi action movie with the guy from Disney, and, you know, I wanted to talk openly about racist police, imperialism, the government's terrible, the president's a liar. Like, come on, man, that's crazy talk.
Yeah,
you just don't see that in like the movies with Dwayne the Rock Johnson or Vin Diesel, right?
Vin Diesel in Escape from New York. Oh, God.
Yeah, he would be, you know, the family memes speak for themselves, but hey, like, you know,
not against it. I'm not against it.
No, but there's this idea
I'm very against it.
Yeah. But like, Carpenter clearly comes from that George Romero school of like, you can make a genre film great, but you can also put political commentary in there. And he does that. And I think
there's even a character named Romero in the movie.
Yeah.
Cronenberg.
Is there really a Cronenberg?
Yeah. There's a Cronenberg and a Romero in Escape from New York.
See, I wasn't paying attention in my recent rewatch. Yeah. quickly, I do want to talk about what did happen after Escape from New York, because it's impossible not to mention this without the sequel, Escape from LA, which was in 1996, I believe. And this is interesting because it's terrible. It is god awful. And what's really sad about it is this is written by Escape from LA. I'm sorry. Is written by Carpenter, Deborah Hill, and Kurt Russell. This is like the trio, the dream team coming together and writing an escape movie. And they just botched it so much. Yeah. And I don't think, Brian, you said you haven't seen the whole sequel, right?
No, I started it and it just, I think I must've gotten bored or something. There was some disconnect there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically it falls in the sequel trap of like, let's do it all over again. Except it's LA instead of New York and it's slightly in the future. And yeah, it's just not good.
And Mike, everything else is terrible. And for some reason there's like weird CGI surfing and just,
cause remember it's the 90s.
So it's like corny and goofy. Yeah. And I don't know. It's just everything.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's, you know, it doesn't take away from Escape from New York, but it kind of just sullies the whole franchise because we never got that definitive Snake Plissken franchise because they botched it. And I want to bring this up too, because from my research, I found that one of Brian's favorite Carpenter movies, Ghosts of Mars, started as Escape from Mars. And was going to be the threequel.
You're Snake kidding. Plissken. Ghost of Mars was going to be a Snake Plissken movie?
Yes. And they did like just a rudimentary rewrite when Escape from LA bombed, and the studio was like, absolutely not. We're not doing another Snake Plissken movie. So they changed it to Ghost of Mars and did a little rewrite, changed the main character from Snake Plissken to, I think his name's like Demolition Williams or something.
And it's
Ice Cube. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now when you watch
all of that information, I'm shocked that Ghost of Mars got a rewrite because couldn't tell me. I could not tell.
Yeah. And so we also, bringing this up, we have to say, like, when we talk about Carpenter as like one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, he does, you know, late career Carpenter is not great. It's hard to say what happened. Maybe he, you know, just was bored. Maybe he was just kind of over it. Maybe he lost creative control. Whatever the case, it doesn't work out. So we specifically talk about this 10-year span for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Stick to the 10-year span. Yeah. Do not venture off the path.
Except for interviews. Watch his interviews. The man is a truth machine. He will tell you everything how it is. He does not care anymore.
Or vampires. Vampires is not bad. I will stand by vampires.
Can I just really quick, a quick aside about vampires. I remember seeing the trailer for Vampires and being so stoked. Like, look at how gory this looks. And James Woods. And I remember showing it to my friend Jeff Nelson and the trailer, I mean, and we were just like high-fiving, like, look at this. This movie is for us. And then not seeing it till it came out on video and thinking, well, this isn't what I wanted. Like, it was.
I recommend you rewatch it. With different eyes.
So?
Yeah, wow. It's a better movie than you're describing. James Woods is good.
I will agree, James Woods is good. I don't, yeah, it's been
so Vampires kind of came out around that From Dusk Till Dawn era, right?
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
it was like so cool to be Tarantino and Vampires, and it definitely got overshadowed by that. I probably haven't seen it since VHS. I miss the days. This is a bit of an aside too. I miss the days where a movie could come out in theaters and you just don't watch it until it comes out in video and you didn't hear anything about it. Like, it was just one of those things where you're like, oh, I remember this came out like 5 months ago, but I didn't get to see it. I'm going to rent on VHS and see what it's about.
That's
nowadays,
true.
You can't do that anymore. You know, if you don't see a movie opening weekend, good luck trying to develop your own opinion. Anyway,
that is true. I do. I miss those days too. Yeah. So many indie films that I discovered on video that, never either didn't come out around here or I just missed them for whatever reason. That was fun. God, that was fun.
Great. Yeah. Like Ghosts of Mars.
Ghosts of Mars.
And John Carpenter's Vampire. Not to be confused with the sequel, Vampires Los Muertos.
Los Muertos.
Wasn't Bon Jovi in that one?
Oh,
was he
Lord.
Not?
Yes, he was.
I did not
see it. John Bon Jovi.
Johnny Bon Jovi. Acclaimed actor, but
okay, we're getting off topic here.
Sorry, we're off topic
here. Yeah, so let's wrap it up on Escape from New York. Anything else you guys want to say about that movie before we move on? Watch it.
Remake it with Wyatt Russell. Watch it.
Stuff. You don't even have to remake it. I would like a redo on the sequel, you know, like a reboot call like they did with Halloween. Ooh. Like, let's do it. Like, let's have like Kurt Russell current because he's awesome still.
Oh, and Lil Snake.
Yeah.
Lil Snake.
We just call him Lil Snake.
What else would he be? Like Scorpion, maybe?
Yeah, just something even more ridiculous.
He's like, Dad.
Snake and Spider.
Spider Plissken.
Spider Plissken.
Yeah, I'm all about it. Either way, yeah. let's bring some more Plissken in. Let's do it.
What character would you say like is akin to Snake Plissken? Like, I can't think of, like, there's plenty of action heroes. There's, you know, John McClane and all them, but who is similar to Snake Plissken?
There isn't like a direct one-to-one. There are a lot of people influenced by him. I would say like even John McClane, the whole like normal guy sort of badass who gets injured. By the end of Escape from New York, he's limping. Like, he's taken some bruises and some bumps. Like, he's not doing well. And he almost dies. Like, it's a pretty crazy situation with Snake. He's never, like, he's not bulging out of his shirt or anything ridiculous like Stallone or Schwarzenegger. Yeah,
it's less about the stuff that came after and what kind of inspired it, which was, like, a lot of the Westerns.
Yeah, he's very much a Westerns.
Yes, he loves Westerns, and he was just kind of taking that archetype and dropping it in a sci-fi movie.
But even still, there are movies. Like, it's again, there's no one-to-one, but there's like some...
Oh, there's definitely
shades of Snake in a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah.
But, I mean, Solid Snake from Metal Gear Solid.
Hey-o.
Hey-o.
Yes, anything with an eye patch, trace it back to Kurt Russell. Speaking of Kurt Russell... Let's move on to 1986's great movie, Big Trouble in Little China, which is celebrating its 35th anniversary. This movie is another Carpenter great. Stars Kurt Russell, except this isn't Snake Plissken Kurt Russell. This is a different type of Kurt Russell, where he's this charismatic trucker dude, handsome guy named Jack Burton, who thinks he's like this badass action hero, but it's actually a bit of a bumbling fool. The movie takes place in basically like Chinatown, and unfortunately it doesn't age too well, because there are a lot of Asian stereotypes rampant in this movie. Not so great Asian stereotypes, I should say.
Still very entertaining,
but yeah, there's the charisma, what he didn't have, or what he had in a different way in Escape from New York, Kurt Russell brings in spades in freaking Big Trouble, where he's basically Dwayne the Rock Johnson 30 years before Dwayne the Rock Johnson. Chris Pratt. He's basically Star-Lord for sure. Yeah. He's just this guy who talks a big game and just can't back it up. I know, Mike, you brought up the Indiana Jones comparison, because it's hard not to talk about this without Indiana Jones, where, you know, they're both kind of these heroes that aren't really great at being heroes, but kind of always win in the end. Except Indy's, you know, the smart guy who's just not much of a, Indy never says he's going to kick your ass and then, you know, loses. Whereas Jack Burton will be like, I'm going to kick your ass, and then you're going to
steal your girl
and
winds up with neither.
Yeah. It's a very different type of movie, but nonetheless, because of the way Kurt Russell plays him, it's highly influential. So I want to go to you guys. What do you guys think of Big Trouble 35 years later?
Every time I watch it, I'm just blown away by how absolutely bonkers the movie is. It's just so, you could never make it again. Even like probably 5 years later, you probably couldn't have made that movie.
No.
But man, it's really entertaining. I rewatched it yesterday. It's just so, like, I don't know how to describe it other than like at times befuddling.
Yeah.
But really likable. Like, it's super, super weird, and there's nothing else like it, I don't think. I mean, could you think of any other movie that's like this movie?
No, not. Yeah. Well, for those that haven't seen it, because I feel like this movie, even more so than Escape from New York, has kind of fallen by the wayside a bit as the years go on, just because of how not PC it is anymore, right? Like, basically the premise is there's this, what is he? Kind of like an Asian spirit, evil guy who has to marry a green-eyed girl. And if he does that, he's able to then have a physical body. And so that's kind of his whole thing, is he's trying to hunt down green-eyed girls. And he kidnaps Jack Burton's friend's girl, like his fiance.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to go to Chinatown and fight. And as you know, anybody who's been to Chinatown knows it's filled with a bunch of Asian people that know magic and kung fu. And and that's kind of where the wheels start to fall off a bit, is because it is very much of that Asian mysticism sort of thing that makes us cringe today. But back then it's like, oh yes, every, you know, Chinese person must know kung fu and definitely, you know, can do some sort of magic and call upon dragon spirits and shit like that. And you know, it's crazy, but yeah,
fingers crossed Marvel can thread that needle, guys, in a couple months.
If you're listening to this after Shang-Chi comes out, hopefully we're wrong, but let's hope, fingers crossed, that movie actually turns out all right. But like, yeah, it's a tough one. And to defend Carpenter a little bit, he does try. It's almost like he knows that this is kind of the stereotype, and whenever he can, he tries to play against it. Like, the music isn't the stereotypical around that era sort of Asian mysticism music, you know. It's very much rock driven and synth driven, as he's known to do. He never does the Asian characters in a way, specifically Kurt Russell's sidekick character. He's never done in a way that's, you know, making fun of him. I'd say he's the true badass of the movie, whereas Jack Burton's kind of the loudmouth. So it's not terrible in that sense, but yeah, it hasn't aged well. There's
what
my
about you, Brian.
That's my legal defense for Big Trouble in Little China, and why everybody should watch it. But Brian, what do you think?
You know, I'm looking at the Wikipedia for this movie, and it very much is touching on what you've described. It's a 1986 American fantasy martial arts action comedy film. Like, yep. Right off the bat. And I would say, like, would you guys characterize this as very much a mid-80s film? I would say yes, because that was such a weird dumping ground for all these just rather bizarre films that have since gone on to become, a lot of them become these like cult classics, which I think, wasn't this one a bomb? Didn't this one bomb?
Oh yeah. Well, so Mike and I were looking at the box office for John Carpenter, and you will not be surprised to know that the highest grossing John Carpenter movie of all time is Halloween, with a whopping $40 million.
47.
Only, 47.
Really?
That's every all it's made? Every other movie that John Carpenter has done far below that number. We're talking 20 millions to.
Wait, is he not a, like, did he, is he considered not like a box office like mastermind?
No.
Wow. I did not know this. That is very interesting.
He might be like the king of the cult classic. Like, every movie that we talk about outside, and again, the movie
The Thing flopped.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. I don't think Escape did very well either.
No. Well, the first Escape, because it only cost $6 million, did all right. But yeah, like, no, it's his movies never do well. And Big Trouble
of Mars did really well. Did really, really, really well.
A $500 million worldwide smash. The thing about Big Trouble, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with the 80s thing. It was a time, maybe it was cocaine fueled, who knows? It was a time when studios were willing to greenlight just about anything. I'm thinking off the top of my head, Howard the Duck, Garbage Pail Kids.
See?
All these like mid 80s, from like 84 to 86 movies, where they were just kind of like, you know, sure. Let's do it, Carpenter.
Like, and apparently he did want to, like, speaking of, before we get off of Huang, Jackie Chan was going to be the original Wang,
right?
Was he really? Well,
oh, so that's just a little tidbit for you.
Yeah, and that goes to show again with my legal defense that Big Trouble in Little China isn't that terrible, is because, you know, he did, like, Carpenter has reverence for the actual like culture of Hong Kong filmmaking.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
So it's, you know, it was done with a love. It was just maybe thought less love.
I get the feeling as I look at this, like, this 10-year span of films, and even as I look at like some of his later films too, that like these are all, it just seems to me like even the ones that suck, that objectively suck, it just seems like he really he doesn't phone in any of them. I think this is a good example of like, this movie is going to be super weird. We'll see how it does, but I want to make this movie. I'm known for making these other types of films. This one I really want to do. And that's like, I can just see like his passion, like even just as the movie starts, you can tell like this is a movie that he's going to tell the story. It's going to come out the way it comes out. I don't think any other, I think as odd as it may be, this might be the most Carpenter film of all his films, especially during that era. Like, it's just weird enough to work.
Yeah,
makes sense.
He's definitely the type of guy that just doesn't care. Like, yeah. He cares about the movies, but he doesn't care what you think about the movies.
Exactly.
And he definitely doesn't care about Hollywood and what they expect. And you know, all of his movies can kind of be seen as a bit of a middle finger to, you know,
the man,
so to speak. But,
but it's still like, it's interesting too. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just like interesting that like it's almost like he knew like eventually you'll get it. You know, like you see like
the Back
like
to the Future thing.
Yeah, like yes.
You like, may not like it, but your kids will love it.
Your kids will love it. Like, it's just, you look at the, like we were just talking about, like the amount of money these movies did not make, but it's almost like he knew like these will catch on eventually. Like, it's just, we gotta get there a bit. And this is one that, yeah, like you guys are saying, and I have other people too that just love this movie now. Just love Big Trouble.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I mean, it spawned like comic books and video games and board games. And, you know, they're actually, I said that The Rock, you know, probably owes this movie, like his career to this movie. He actually has for years been trying to remake this or make a sequel to this movie. It's lived on in a way that you could argue that outside of Halloween, not a lot of his other movies, Carpenter's movies have. It's groomed this huge fan base. People love Jack Burton just because, you know, other, you know, stereotypes and characters aside, like Jack Burton is a great creation. And just like Snake Plissken, these are characters that, you know, we didn't see a lot of. There is no Big Trouble 2. And there probably never will be. Like, and even if there is, even if The Rock makes it, and you know, he's gonna put like $150 million into it, you know, it's gonna be such a sanitized PG-13 version. Like, it's just, it's not gonna be the same.
Yep.
Yep. So,
but I'd watch it.
I of course watch it. Brian, this is the moment I would allow you to talk about the music, because every one of these movies, this is Carpenter, and you can hear a Carpenter score from a mile away. It's very much his music, his way. Even, you know, after synthesizers might not have been used nearly as much before, 10 years later, he's still doing it, you know, 20, 30 years later even. So what is it, do you think, about Carpenter, his music, his scores, that makes them so unique?
I was thinking about this earlier, and I guess I'm having a hard time finding another filmmaker that does their own music. And what I mean by that is, I know that there's other filmmakers that do their own scores, but they don't always pull it off. Not only did Carpenter pull it off, but he did create, I would say, the Halloween theme is as recognizable as Jaws. And like, I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Like, right. So you're right. You can hear like there is a similarity amongst his soundtracks, but enough of a difference at the same time.
He likes a good synth.
And my brother is a huge Carpenter fan, and specifically a Carpenter music fan. So, and he loves like just old synth soundtracks, loves Goblin.
I love Goblin too.
Yeah. So he's turned me on to a lot of this and a lot of Carpenter stuff, like for movies that, soundtracks that I've heard, but haven't seen the movie. And, it's now with like Stranger Things and, you know, how that's kind of bringing back the synth soundtracks. It's obvious that that's a wink and a nod toward Carpenter, the show itself, but also the music. I think it's great. So I'll forever have a hard on for that. He likes a good resume.
Yeah. Sparse synth laden kind
super
of
super sparse. Yes.
And then, you know, something that sews dread really well.
It's never bombastic either. No. Like I was reading somewhere where maybe it was Wiki, maybe it was an interview where Hans Zimmer like cites him as like an influence.
And, he does. Oh, cool.
And it's crazy because you think of Hans Zimmer, you think of like, you know, Inception and things like that, where it's just
drums. Yes.
You know, and then you listen to a Carpenter thing and it's like ding, 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 ding. You know, it's just it's a completely different vibe. Stuff. Yeah. I was watching Escape from New York, and like I said, the whole, I guess, like first like 3-4 minutes of the movie is just, you know, his music over title cards. Like,
yes,
he's not hiding behind the music either. Like, he's like, this is my music. It fucking rocks.
There are so many times
on tour.
Like where I've just been watching a movie and I'll just pay attention to the music and I will miss something. I'll miss some dialogue or I'll miss some on-screen action because his music, it's quite obvious he wants to push it to the front just a little bit, maybe too much. Maybe that's a detriment to the film, but it's hard to argue when it's that good. So yeah, stop directing to start composing music for films.
Or just do it all.
He's done.
Yeah. I mean, he writes, he directs, he does his music. He, you know, he even acts sometimes in his movies. Go right ahead. Mm-hmm. Do it all. Yeah. So yeah, we can all agree his music's incredible. And if you aren't familiar with it, just go on Spotify and listen to some of the scores. They're nuts. Just how, you know, they're very much of the era in the sense that like you think of synths, you immediately are brought back to like that 80s nostalgia. But there's also something so timeless and eerie about all of his music that only John Carpenter could make. There's nobody else. Again, there's nobody else doing music like him either.
And the thing too is like a lot of people will think, oh, the Halloween theme. Okay. Well, but the rest of his music is so much better. The Halloween theme is so recognizable, but there are so many other soundtracks of his that are just a million times better that people just, if they would just pay attention just a little bit,
I don't know about that. I think the Halloween good. Theme and score is just
Oh no, it's great.
Do you guys remember back in the early days of the cell phone when you had to pay for ringtones?
Oh yeah.
I remember paying for the Halloween theme as my ringtone just because I was like, I have to have that music on my phone.
If my wife hears it, she like immediately makes me turn it off. She cannot.
Really?
she's scared of even the theme. So yeah,
that's hilarious. Yeah, so it's great. So moving on, this is interesting. In my little bit of research on the internet about Carpenter, I found some movies that he was offered, but he turned down because, again, you make these movies, they're not huge box office hits, but they're undeniably good. And of course, you're going to get other offers. So I'm going to go through these movies and I want your honest opinion with each. So first one, this is kind of a cop-out because he turned down this movie to do Big Trouble because he knew they are both very similar and he chose Big Trouble. And the movie I'm talking about is Golden Child. The really Eddie Murphy vehicle. Yeah, so the story goes that, as Carpenter says, they hadn't made a movie, an American movie about Asian mysticism for decades, but somehow two studios came out with the same story in Golden Child and Big Trouble at the same time, and there was like a race to do it. And so he was offered Golden Child, but then read the script for Big Trouble and chose Big Trouble, even though he was almost swayed by Eddie Murphy, because Eddie Murphy starred in Golden Child. And as a fan of Golden Child, because I love Eddie Murphy, they're very different movies.
Oh, yes.
And I, there is a sick part of me that would love to see a John Carpenter Golden Child, but yeah, I think he made the right choice.
Yeah. Strangely enough, Kurt Russell, didn't he turn down Highlander for that movie?
For Big Trouble?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh.
That's interesting though.
Yeah, I believe it's...
He would have been a good Highlander too.
It would have been... an interesting alternate history for sure. Yeah.
God, I don't think anybody else could have been Jack Burton though.
No. I'm glad he went the route he did.
Yep. Okay. So next movie that Carpenter turned down in the 80s, Top Gun.
Oh
yeah. Another movie that's coming back as a new thing. Apparently Carpenter was offered Top Gun. He read it. He's like, I can't do anything with this.
How many times does it say greased up men?
Yeah. And obviously Top Gun ended up going to Tony Scott, who was an incredible filmmaker, sadly passed away. And Tony Scott, just like fucking Top Gun and Tony Scott are just like synonymous. So yeah, it all worked out in the end.
Another amazing score.
Yes.
Yeah, wow. And we're psyched for Maverick. Yes.
Oh, I am. Yeah.
Of course.
They should have called it Danger Zone, but it's Tom Cruise. He's got to call it Maverick, whatever. Okay. Another movie, Exorcist Part 3. Because, you know, Carpenter does horror. Might as well throw him on an Exorcist movie. Do you guys remember Exorcist Part 3?
Here's the thing. I've never seen any of the Exorcist movies.
Well, I can't believe that for a second. You need to go watch The Exorcist right away.
I feel like it's too late. Like, I've seen all like the upgraded versions. So maybe I'll revisit it.
Exorcist is another one of those movies that I watched at an entirely too young age. However, I was obsessed with it when they did that re-release, that R-rated re-release. I think it was like 2000 or 99. I was like so psyched for it as this little horror movie nerd that I go to the theaters opening night, midnight showing. I'm like ready to be blown away. And all these people in the theater are laughing at the movie and on their phones. It was the 20 years later is like the worst movie going experience of my life. And so I think Exorcist doesn't hold up the way it, like if you're going to it thinking like, oh, this is like The Conjuring, you're going to be sorely mistaken.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But it is incredible. But Exorcist 3 is really interesting. If you guys want to like go back and rewatch the Exorcist movies, watch the first one, skip the second one, watch the third one. It's not good, but it's a very interesting concept. And it would have been interesting to see what Carpenter could have done with it. But yeah, of course, he passed on that. Another 80s movie he passed on, Firestarter.
Oh, Drew Barrymore.
Yep. Firestarter with Drew Barrymore, which they are remaking right now, Blumhouse's, I believe, with Zac Efron. So, look forward to that. I think they're filming that right this moment.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Now, this is the one that made me do a double take when I read Fatal Attraction.
Oh, that could have worked.
An erotic thriller with John Carpenter. I don't know. He famously said, like, you know, he passed on it because it reminded him too much of another movie. And then I'm forgetting what that movie was. But yeah, he basically shit on the movie on the way out. And so, you know, this is a hunk of garbage. And then Adrian Lyne comes up and does the movie, and it becomes like kind of a classic erotic thriller that spawned countless other imitators.
Yeah. Huh.
All right. This one's kind of obvious, but interesting. Halloween H2O.
Yeah, that came close. I honestly really like Halloween H2O.
It's
the Scream of Halloween's, but still, it is thoroughly entertaining.
Have you seen it recently?
Comparison.
Yes, I still love it.
Okay, last Halloween, the holiday, I watched it because it was on like one of those marathons. It's okay because as Jamie Lee Curtis.
It's not amazing, but it's, I think.
But Josh Hartnett with his hair is a little weird. There's so many Hartnett. Dawson's Creek-y parts where you're like, ooh. But yeah, it's
Great. Stuff. I think it's because I was a teenager when that came out that I have this sweet, sweet nostalgic spot for it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of nostalgia.
That fits that era perfectly with I Know What You Did Last Summer and Scream. Ooh, it is a perfect late 90s slasher.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So the story there is Carpenter asked for $10 million to direct it, and they laughed and said, no, thank you. And this one, too, is very interesting. The last one I'll mention, Zombieland.
Oh.
Now, this is weird because it wasn't the movie version of Zombieland. Back before it was a movie, it was pitched originally as a TV show. Yes, it was eventually made into a TV show, but before that, it was pitched as a TV show and Carpenter was going to do it. And then they ended up morphing it into a movie. He stepped away and Ruben Fleischer came along and made the Zombieland we know and love.
So he would have been like the showrunner basically on this.
He would have directed episodes. I don't know that the showrunner title was so much of a thing back then. This like 2005, 2006.
Strange.
Yeah. I can't imagine a John Carpenter Zombieland, but then again, I would
More low budget, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yes. But I would be super interested to see his take on a zombie movie for sure. Like a full Romero-esque zombie movie.
Yeah. In the 80s though.
Well, I mean, even if he made it in 2021, it would be very much a product of the 80s, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
that was kind of his heyday.
I was just saying I would have preferred to see him do it when he was good things.
again, yeah, late career. So here, let's wrap up. We'll talk briefly about late career John Carpenter. So John Carpenter goes off and he does these, this incredible run of 10 years of just like classic, 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 classic. And then he has a couple bombs and the bombs hit hard with a thud. Yeah. And we're talking After They Live, he did Memoirs of Invisible Man in 1992, which
one of Brian's favorites.
Yeah. You can't help but think like, ooh, that was a rough one. But then he did In the Mouth of Madness, which is whatever, Village of the Damned, meh. And then it's like his big one's going to be Escape from LA. And as we said before, boof, hit with a thud. Mm-hmm. Then Vampires gets overshadowed by like From Dusk Till Dawn. He then goes and does Ghosts of Mars in 2001. And then he basically says, fuck Hollywood.
Yep.
And he says, I'm out of here in 2001. And he doesn't direct a movie until The Ward in 2010, which didn't get great reviews. Not a lot of people remember. I
forgot
it.
About that one.
Yeah, it had right. Amber Heard. Jared Harris. It's not a great movie by any stretch, but it just it was a low budget movie that didn't, you know, set anybody's box office on fire or anything.
Yeah.
So 2010, that movie doesn't do well. The big John Carpenter comeback is a bust, and he basically just says, "Fuck it, I'm gonna go play video games." And that's what he's been doing. And it wasn't until Halloween, the 2018 one, where he kind of came back in the spotlight and started doing interviews again, because he wasn't like writing or creating that movie in any way, but they did consult him. And that's a pretty good, I think we can.
And he did the score.
He did the score, of course.
Yes.
Which they, of course, riffed on his theme. He kind of rewrote it a bit and then, you know, did more with the score. And I believe he's back doing music for Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends. Mm-hmm.
Good.
And I'm looking up Halloween Kills right now, and it looks like his son, Cody Carpenter, is doing the music for Halloween Kills with
Pad. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know Cody Carpenter's mom is Adrienne Barbeau, who is from Escape from New York.
Yep. They were married for a short period of time, I think.
Yeah. And at least, you know. But yeah, so Carpenter's doing stuff, not a lot of stuff. mainly, I think
he's earned the right to do whatever the fuck he wants.
Oh, yeah. And I read a lot of interviews and wrote a lot about Carpenter over the last few years because of Halloween. And the basic log line he gives now is he's willing to, you know, you can take whatever property of his you want. He'll sign off on it as long as you pay him with a nice check. And he's just going to be content with playing like NBA Live, I think is his game of choice.
Oh, and, awesome.
And yeah, cash and checks, making music, like that's what he wants to do. And yeah, he's fucking deserved it.
Yeah.
I always felt that, like, I think it was around the time of In the Mouth of Madness, that was around the time that I really started to like pay attention to.
That's when you started to pay attention to him.
No, like when movies, like what reviews they were getting, or like how many stars they get in the paper, or like starting to be aware of like how much money this movie was making. And I had known who John Carpenter was, but then like, I think In the Mouth of Madness was the first time I kind of like, oh, okay, this is a John Carpenter film. And I don't remember how old I was. I was probably like maybe 12, and just noticing like, every time I'd hear, oh, there's a John Carpenter movie coming out. I remember thinking this, especially with Escape from LA, they just kept getting released around times that they were buried. Like I remember Escape from LA coming out in the summer of 96, when I think was the first summer I ever really paid attention to like the blockbusters. And I remember reading like Cinescape and thinking, wow, this is gonna be a great summer for movies. We've got like Independence Day and Mission Impossible and this Escape from LA movie that's getting really heavily touted here. And they all just kept getting like, just the timing I thought was always so awful. Like there were always more prominent films coming out and these movies just kept getting, overshadowed again and again, like Village of the Damned. I didn't even know about that until I think that was on video. So
I just remember the poster for that movie was super creepy with the kids.
With the girls at the, that.
I don't know that I ever saw the full movie. I just know the trailer and the poster really well.
Yeah. Christopher Reeve, Kirstie Alley. I mean, Mark Hamill.
Did you guys like any of his late career films or even like tolerate?
I can tolerate Vampires. Yeah. Vampires. Yeah. The Ward isn't terrible. It's whatever. It's just, it doesn't feel very Carpenter-esque, unfortunately. In the Mouth of Madness is whatever. Again, It's tough because you think of Ghosts of Mars as kind of like the quintessential, and Escape from LA, the late career Carpenter. And those just movies are not good. And
those are awful. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's more upsetting when you see what he did before and how, like Mike said, he basically created genres, you know, like Halloween was like, okay, there were slasher movies pre-Halloween, not a lot of them. They're very low budget. And he was like, he had a legitimacy to the slasher movie to the point where Friday the 13th is a direct, there's a reason why there are a whole bunch of holiday themed slasher movies. Yes, Black Christmas, I think, came out before this, but Halloween really did sort of set the stage for like, okay, Friday the 13th and all these other holiday themed
slashers. It made it a thing. It legitimized
slasher movies. Yeah. Then you have Escape from New York is this like almost post-apocalyptic sort of Mad Max-y thing, but then with a Snake Plissken, which has never really been seen before. The Thing kind of really revolutionized horror in a way that really wasn't done before, and that's a remake, which is crazy to think about. And then you know, Big Trouble in Little China, you said it, Brian, there's like five genres that movie covers, like it's all over the place. He's kind of a one-of-a-kind filmmaker, and that's great. There just aren't other people that could do the movies he did.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Yeah, it's because he has his fingers in everything, like writing, direction, composing, editing in some cases.
Yeah.
Yes.
When he's just like,
when you learn. Yeah. When you learn about what all he's capable of, it just makes you just respect the guy more.
And then you watch Ghosts of Mars and you go, what the fuck, John?
What have you done?
John Carpenter, you're terrible. No, we love John Carpenter. And one day we'll intro this and we'll actually have an interview with John Carpenter, maybe. We won't have to pretend.
Hopefully he doesn't hear this.
No, we are huge John Carpenter fans. But yeah, so that's where we're at now. It's middle of July 2021 and we're telling you to watch a movie from 35 years ago and 40 years ago. Because honestly, it's probably better than Fast 9.
Hey, you know, I love myself some Fast and Furious. They're not comparable.
You're right. They're not comparable. Fucking Vin Diesel family. Ugh. Are they going to bring Brian back? I guess.
Of course they are. Because
CGI Paul Walker.
Yeah.
What are these movies?
They're terrible is what they are.
Yes, but that's the charm.
And what? Mr. Nobody. Wasn't that Kurt Russell? Bring it all full circle.
Yes.
Arguably, the Fast and Furious franchise would not exist without John Carpenter. That's what I'm getting at.
Also, wait a minute. Didn't I read that Hateful Eight was inspired by The Thing? Isn't that correct?
Probably.
Yes. Oh. It was like he did like a deep dive into it one time where he talked about all the scenes that were inspired by it.
Sweet. Wait, you mean to tell me a Quentin Tarantino movie was inspired by a better movie? Crazy. Oh boy. Yeah.
Hey, Quentin, I like Tarantino. Me some Tarantino. Come on.
That's whatever. I mean, it's whatever. It's a whole other podcast we'll have to get to is going over Tarantino stuff because I've got thoughts, especially after these interviews he's been giving lately. It's pretty
what is he doing? What is he doing lately?
He's promoting his book.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
He is.
You know, because everybody loves Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm
shitting
so
on Bruce
much.
Lee.
You know what John Carpenter would never do? Shit on Bruce Lee. That's all I'm saying.
No, I'm sure he would if he had the chance.
No,
Carpenter would shit on anyone.
If a paycheck was involved, possibly. Okay. In that case, let's wrap this up. It's been great, guys, talking with you guys again, where we don't have to do an interview and we can just shoot the shit about John Carpenter and talk about 80s movies because those are the best movies. And we'll do it again soon. But
to the five dudes that this conversation was, you know, for, thanks for hanging in there.
Yeah. If you've made it this far, we love you. And
you're our kind of people.
You really should seek us out and be friends with us because, we love you guys. All right. Thank you. And we'll talk soon. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye.